We're talking about sleep for the hour and what research on mice could tell us about how we learn and how our brain health functions. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers at UW-Madison have uncovered a new reason why the brain requires sleep. So there's solid established research on how sleep is connected to our long-term memory and learning, but now there's new evidence suggesting actual physical changes in our brain that help pave the way for the brain to keep learning each day. And so we're going to learn about what those physical changes are. What questions do you have about a good night's sleep? Are you curious about what's happening in your brain while you're sleeping? We're at 800-642-1234. Join in at any point. Dr. Chiara Cirelli is a professor in UW-Madison's psychiatry department and a principal investigator at the Center for Sleep and Consciousness. Dr. Cirelli, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you very much.
So your study was published recently in the Journal of Neurosciences examining how the brain physically changes in these sleep-deprived mice. So how similar are the brains of mice and people?
They are actually quite similar in the fundamentals of how the anatomy, the structure of the brain works. And that's why we think we can use mice to learn many things about sleep and many other functions. And there are fundamental similarities that actually are shared not only between mice or mammals in general and in humans, but they go back even to flies. And that's why actually all our studies, including some of the structural studies that we are going to cover in this conversation, we study them also in flies, because we think there are, again, basic similarities, especially when we look at fundamental processes like sleep, that should be shared across species. But mice, of course, are closer to humans than flies. That's why we very often use them as models.
So these are adolescent mice in your lab. How did your study measure changes in the brains of these mice?
So the changes that we were looking for were supposed and indeed are very small, because we are looking at changes in the specific connections that are linking neurons, the brain cells, to each other. Those are the fundamentals, the basis of how the brain works. Neurons need to communicate to each other, need to transmit signals, and they do so through these connections that are called synapses.
So these synapses, they grow stronger in mice that were kept awake and forced to explore objects for 6 to 7 hours?
Correct. So the idea, this is actually the last of a long series of experiments that we have done over the last, indeed, 20 years to test a general idea about why we need to sleep, which is called the synaptic homeostasis hypothesis. So the take-home message of this idea is, in fact, that sleep is the price we pay to learn and be plastic, to be able to change and adapt to the environment every day. If we didn't sleep, we would not be able tomorrow to learn new things and to adapt. And we think the way this works is that when we are awake, we are always learning something new. It's not only when we go to a lecture, to a class, because if you think about every day when you go out of your house, you need to adapt to a changing environment. And that's what learning is. And we know in the brain, based on a lot of studies, that this learning happens exactly by changing these connections, these synapses. And the change usually is by making these synapses stronger, because then they are more able to help the communication among neurons. So this is good. This is how we learn. But making synapses stronger means, first of all, that they are also more energetically expensive. They need literally more energy to run. And of course, if you keep making them stronger and stronger, at one point they will saturate. They will get to a point, a ceiling, and no more learning will be possible. So, of course, there is a need of renormalization. Everybody understands that in the field of learning and memory. But we think that this renormalization happens more preferentially during sleep. Sleep is the perfect time to do that. Now, how you test this idea is not so easy to measure this strength, efficacy of these connections. And that's why it's taking 20 years. One study that we can do, one approach, and that's the one that pertains to the last experiment, is that there is a very good correlation between how strong functionally these synapses are and how big they are. So literally, if they are stronger, they're also bigger. So we reason that if it's true that overall we learn during waking and many of these synapses get stronger, they should also be bigger. So if we were to look with a very powerful imaging method with a microscope at their size on average, we should see that they are bigger and vice versa. After sleep, they should literally shrink. And so that's what we did. But of course, these changes are minute, and that's why you need electron microscopy to do that. So this study was done by serial electron microscopy, by taking the brains of these animals after their major waking period, or we try to enrich their waking experience even more, giving them opportunity to learn by giving them novel objects, and then comparing them to animals that instead were just allowed to sleep.
We're talking about sleep and what it has to do with brain health. Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is a professor in UW-Madison Psychiatry Department, and she's a principal investigator at the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. And we've been looking at sleep. We all have been sleep deprived at one point or another. You can join in. Tell us about a bad night's sleep and how it affects you and what prevents you from getting those 7 to 9 hours a night. Join in the conversation at any point here at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Chiarelli, how does this latest study on mice, how does it fit into your broader theory about what is happening in our brain during sleep?
It's consistent. As I said, I mentioned it's very difficult to measure synaptic strength in general. So the approach has been in our lab to try as many methods as possible in as many animal models as possible. Again, starting from the assumption, which I think is very well grounded in evidence, that sleep has such a fundamental essential function that is conserved across species. There is every animal species that we have studied in the field, and is maybe 240 total, all of them have been found to sleep. So we have no evidence that there is a group of animals, an animal species, that does not need the sleep. And that tells a lot about, evidently, the fact that sleep is very important. Because if you think about sleeping, puts you potentially in a very dangerous situation. Because by definition, when you are asleep, you lose the ability to very promptly respond to any threat. Yes, especially, of course, through evolution. Think about animals living in the wild. So there must be at least one reason why sleep has been conserved through evolution, despite this obvious problem.
We can't engineer sleep out of our lives. We're learning about what happens in our brain when we sleep. Neuroscientists are suggesting that there's a physical rebalancing effect that goes on. Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is a professor in UW-Madison Psychiatry Department. What questions do you have about what happens to your brain when you sleep? Are you curious about moments between sleep and wakefulness? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Back for more sleep conversation in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're learning about what happens in our brain as we sleep. A good night's sleep is vital for every human being to survive. Average person will sleep about a third of their life. And researchers at UW-Madison have found that sleeping is responsible for some of the physical changes that prepare the brain to learn each day. And the findings were published this month in the Journal of Neuroscience. Are you curious about what's happening in your brain while you're sleeping? We've all been sleep deprived at one point or another, but tell us about a bad night's sleep and how it affects you. Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is a professor in UW-Madison's psychiatry department. She's a principal investigator at the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness, and she stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Cheryl joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. My question is, my thought is, I've noticed that I have nightmares in the morning that make me wake up feeling very tense. But sometimes if I take supplements, like a magnesium or something, they're lessened. Are there other thoughts you have about sleeping and avoiding enjoying better sleep, especially as it comes towards the morning and avoiding nightmares?
You know, I'm not a sleep clinician. What I know is that, I don't know if you have been diagnosed with a specific sleep disorder. I would advise you to search, to look for, advice from a clinician first, because it's very, very often we are very bad judges of our own sleep. So there are many sleep disorders that could bring about the symptoms that you are describing. And the point is that it's not, often trying to find the rule without really knowing what's happening, it can be very difficult. So it might be a good idea for you to try to schedule a sleep study so that you can know exactly what's happening. Many people report very often there is a disconnection between the actual objective quality of sleep and the subjective quality of sleep. And it's very important to know whether that disconnection is present or not. Having said that, you are again one demonstration of the fact that there are many reasons why our sleep might be not optimal. And very often is not so much the total amount of sleep, but is the quality of sleep. And so it's very often say that we need on average 7 hours, anywhere between 6 and 8 hours of sleep, which is true in the sense that overall across the general population, that's what you find. But the reality that we have been, as a field, realizing is that there is huge inter-individual variability. Each of us is different and needs a different amount of sleep. And this is true through our lifespan, actually. It's also true even in newborns. And so you are the best judge of exactly how much you need to sleep. And how do you judge that? When you wake up in the morning, and if you feel that something is not right, then you cannot go through the day in the best way, with energy, with not feeling like you need to put so much effort to do what you need to do, then it means you don't have enough sleep. Even if perhaps the amount of the hours of sleep that you are getting are okay, are according to the rules, but there is really no good rule. You are the best judge of how much you need to sleep.
Dr. Chiarelli, do animals have nightmares? Do mice in your lab have nightmares? What goes on there?
I would assume that they do. I would assume that they have dreams the way we do, based, again, on many similarities in terms of their sleep, the features of their sleep, and the way their brain is organized. But of course, in humans, still, the golden standard and the way we assess nightmares, dreams, even very pleasant dreams, is by asking people, is by what we call the report. So you wake up and we do a lot of this research, but you have to rely on the report that you get from a human subject. You cannot get from a mouse. Having said that, now there is new evidence that is coming actually from our Center for Sleep and Consciousness, in exactly with the aim of trying to find, to go beyond the report and to find signatures in the brain that would allow us to predict whether or not you were dreaming, and perhaps in the future whether those dreams were actually nightmares and were bad, etc., based on the brain activity without having to rely on the report. So this is research that is going on, and it seems very promising, but is not established still.
Sleep, as you mentioned, makes animals vulnerable to their environment. They could be eaten or attacked. Why hasn't an animal evolved that, you know, without needing sleep? How have we not engineered sleep out of the living person or animals' lives?
Well, that's the fundamental question that we are trying to answer, and we think the answer is indeed that if sleep is important for this process of renormalization of synaptic connections, which is then fundamental for the entire brain to learn and adapt, which from an evolutionary standpoint is essential. To do that, you need to sample all your connections and decide which one need to be strengthened or maintained and which one can be pruned or removed because they're actually related to noise or something that is irrelevant in the long run or that needs to be forgotten. To do that, you need to be offline. If you do that when you are online awake, you risk of doing something very biased depending on what you are doing that specific day, that specific hour. And instead is when you are asleep that indeed you are no longer slave of the here and now, and you can do this, very comprehensive process of renormalization. That's why...
Oh, it's more efficient if we just sleep.
One fundamental feature of sleep that we think allows this process of overall weakening and renormalization is that many of the molecules that are in our brain express a very high level when we are awake, and they are fundamental for us to learn. Many neurotransmitters, many systems, many brain group of neurons are very active during wake. They are helping us to learn. They release these substances. All these substances allow the learning and are very not conducive to the weakening and the renormalization. In sleep, all these systems are shut off. And so the very same neuromodulatory milieu, all the molecules that are in the brain during sleep are in themselves conducive to the renormalization. It would be very, very difficult in wake to get it both ways. You're trying to learn something and yet you want to, you know, weaken.
Those neurons are saying, hey, you're making us do too much here.
Yes, and you would risk to do that, again, in a very not smart way.
We're discussing what happens in our brain as we sleep, and findings on adolescent mice, even fruit flies, give us new clues. Dr. Kiera Chiarelli is a professor in UW-Madison Psychiatry Department. She's with the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. What do you want to know about your physical changes after you've slept well? What do you want to know about REM, rapid eye movement in sleep? Join in at 800-642-1234. Dr. Chiarelli, you studied sleep in fruit flies. How did you actually do that? They're so small.
They are small, but the fundamental starting point to study sleep in any animal species, actually, is by just looking at their behavior. Because in almost all animals, the feature is that we are relatively quiet and immobile when we are asleep. And so first we look at them and we notice that indeed during the night, because flies are like us, they are diurnal animals, so they're active during the day. During the night, they can stay quiet, immobile, not moving at all, for hours. Now, this in itself is a very good starting point, but is not essential, is not sufficient, because again, sleep is more than just quiescence. When we are asleep, we have to lose this ability to respond. So what we call the arousal threshold. So you need to test in these animals whether they can respond to a stimulus or not. And we can do that in flies. You know, we can see how quickly they respond to a noise, to a vibration, to something that is meaningful in their normal life. And that's what we did. And we found that, indeed, they are less able. That's the fundamental feature. So their ability to respond to a stimulus decreases. So the arousal threshold, as we call it, increases. That's the definition of sleep.
We're spending the hour discussing what happens in our brain as we sleep. And Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is our guide. She is a professor in UW-Madison Psychiatry Department, principal investigator at the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. What troubles you about your sleep? Are you wondering how your brain works to file things when you're in sleep? Do you see changes in how your sleep was years ago versus today? Join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we'll look at what our smart devices can tell us about our sleep. That's after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the latest in sleep research this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You know, our cell phones, our tablets, our electronic gadgets have become such a huge part of our daily lives. It's often hard to put them down. Even at bedtime, people use their smartphones now as their alarm clock, myself included. And the National Sleep Foundation says we should keep our bedrooms a technology-free zone. We're exploring the physical changes in our brain as we sleep. Are you curious about what's happening in your brain while you sleep? We've all been sleep deprived. Tell us about a bad night's sleep and how it affects you. How do your electronic devices help or hurt your sleep? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is our guide. She's been studying sleep for decades. Let's go to the phones now with Terry joining us from Madison. Hi, Terry.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So my question is, you know, I've always had really short sleep cycles, even as a child, you know, waking up frequently during the night with periods of being awake. And my mom always told me that it didn't matter if I slept or not, as long as I relaxed. And I suspect that she also had these short sleep cycles. So can we talk a little bit about you know, in terms of when you wake up during the night, what are some things that are useful to do in particular for your brain? Relaxing, or I've oftentimes read it's better to get up and do something.
I would say whatever works for you. There is no general rule, but it's absolutely a good, you know, general approach if you are not able to go to sleep, to wake up and do something and try to get tired and mount what we call the sleep pressure. Now, having short, what you say, short sleep cycles maybe means that you wake up frequently and therefore you remember these periods when you are awake. But that doesn't mean that when you sum up all your pieces of sleep, you don't actually reach what you need. You know, it's very different. Some people, most of us actually, interrupt sleep because we wake up for a few seconds or even minutes, but many of us just don't remember that part. And so it seems to us the sleep is just consolidated and we do it for hours and hours, but in fact we don't. So it's not necessarily the case that if you remember that you woke up for a few minutes, that's a bad sign. It's the way you are. And there is, as I said, a lot of variability.
Is the way we sleep have any hereditary function to that? Terry mentioned Terry's mother might have had these short sleep cycles as well.
Definitely, we know now there is a genetic component. So there are genes, some of which have been very clearly identified in flies especially, a little bit in mice and in people, that do affect the ability to go to sleep very early or very late. You know, some of us prefer to go at 9 p.m., others cannot go to sleep until 1 a.m. That runs in families as a strong genetic component. Having said that, especially in complex brains, already mice, much more than in flies, and even more so, of course, in people, the number of genes that are affecting sleep, sleep duration, sleep quality, general features of sleep is so high that it's very difficult to pinpoint to one of them. So yes, there is a genetic component, but it's probably not the most, for the great majority of people, that's not the most important fact.
Well, Marie in Monona is wondering, she sleeps about 5 to 6 hours during the week and then tries to catch up on weekends. Is this an adequate way to keep up on sleep by sleeping more on the weekends?
Well, it's better than nothing, but as I say, my students, don't do that as a general rule, because there is now a lot of evidence that, you know, most of us, when we are talking about the consequence, the bad consequence of sleep, bad sleep, and it's not total sleep deprivation, it's this chronic condition of sleep restriction in which we just are short of maybe 1 or 2 hours every day. For that condition, trying to catch up during the weekend just doesn't work. Meaning you, of course, you feel a little bit better, but if I test you in many vigilance tasks or memory tasks, there is still evidence of impairment even the Monday after you overslept
still
during
a deficit.
The weekend. So, you know, it's better than nothing, but don't count on that as being able really to, you know, restore your capacity if you are chronically sleep restricted.
Let's bring in Julia now in Cross Plains. Hi, Julia.
Hi. I have a question about screens and sleep. You know, you were mentioning that you shouldn't, you know, have screens in your bedroom and things. Well, how about this whole generation now of middle schoolers and high schoolers and college students who go to bed with their screen and lie in bed doing their screens until late hours? And it seems to be a chronic problem these days, and I've seen it in my family. I'm just wondering what can be done about that.
I'm not sure what can be done, but it's definitely bad. It's bad because the light that comes from these screens is going to affect the ability of initiating sleep. And so it delays, especially in adolescents, it delays the moment in which we can finally go to sleep. And so there is a lot of evidence for that. So even just because of that, because of the light exposure, that should be avoided. The other reason, of course, is then people usually do that because it's very engaging. And so it's very, you know, waking up your brain, literally. The same way it's not a good idea to do strong physical exercise just before going to sleep. Because, again, exercising very strenuously activates the same systems that I mentioned before about learning and about the systems that are very active during wake. And so those systems then are very active and you are trying to go to sleep. The same is true for, you know, brain exercise. If you try to look and you follow engaging stories, that's not going to help you to relax. But the fundamental effect, the early one, is really the light exposure.
We're talking about what happens to the brain when we sleep. Dr. Kira Chiarelli is a professor in UW-Madison Psychiatry Department, and she's been studying sleep for decades. Let's bring in Gordon now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Gordon.
Hello. Thank you for taking the call. I appreciate it. I am a clinician and a psychologist, and of course, insomnia and sleep problems are very common issues. Sometimes when I work with people, for example, who have nightmares, it's possible to have a dreaming state where you're sort of awake slightly and aware that you're dreaming. I think that might be called lucid dreaming. And it's possible, if you're aware of that, that you can actually make a dream have a different ending, reorient the story, the outcome, so to speak. I wonder if the doctor has any ideas on how lucid dreaming works, how one can have both be asleep and semi-aware of being asleep and dreaming.
Yes, that's a very good question. So I don't know, but we are trying to find out. And, you know, the dreaming research in general had in the field quite a bad reputation until recently. Now we are studying, I mentioned before, before it was basically dreaming research was only based on reports. You have to wake up the subject and ask what was going on in their mind. Now this is no longer the case. We can study, especially with a high-density EEG, what happens exactly during dreaming in the brain. And we have learned, for instance, that absolutely is not the case that is only dreaming happens only in a phase of sleep that is called REM sleep. It happens also in non-REM sleep. And we know which brain regions, is not the entire brain, there are some brain regions that are more directly involved in happening of the dreaming than others. The same is true for lucid dreaming. It's a new area of research. Lucid dreaming has had a very bad reputation for a long time, but now we know it's a real phenomenon. It's very difficult, but some people can do that. They can control their dreams and they can make them happen or end the way they want. And
can you train your brain to do that?
Yes, you can train. There are tricks. I'm not a lucid dreamer, so I don't know, but yes, you can. And you can study. It's very difficult. We have done one study. We are running studies in the sleep center. It's very difficult because very few people can do that. And when you ask them to come to the lab, it's even more difficult, of course. But you can communicate because the way that they learn to communicate to you through eye movements when they are in the lucid dreaming state, because they are not always like that. It may happen, you know, once every week or even not so often. So you need to know. And based on that, then we can relate when the lucid dreaming happened, what was in the brain that was specific to that condition relative to any other dreaming condition. And we are starting to learn that indeed there is a very specific signature in the brain. So it's a real phenomenon, but it's too early to say exactly why we can do that. But we, at least now we have a way that is more objective than before. It was, again, just based on the report to understand that.
We're learning all we can about what happens in the brain as we sleep. It's the latest on sleep research and the mysteries that are still out there about sleep. Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is a principal investigator at the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness at UW-Madison. Do you have questions about what you remember from your dreams? Are you curious about why you can't quiet your brain to get a restful night's sleep? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll be back in just a moment for more on sleep here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour unlocking the mysteries of sleep, and sleep has perplexed scientists for a very long time. There's no research on mice that's providing new discoveries about what it does for both our brain and our body. Sleep deprivation causes our attention, working memory, and our ability to learn and remember decline. But why is that? What is really going on in our brains? Why can't we do more with less? Still time for your questions on sleep, 800-642-1234. Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is fielding your questions. She's a professor in the psychiatry department at UW-Madison, where she has studied sleep for decades. Let's go back to the phones now with Catherine in Madison. Hi, Catherine.
Good morning. So I've been interested in sleep for a long time, and I could ask a million questions, but I settled on one. Dr. Chiarelli mentioned a minute ago that there's a hereditary component to the circadian cycles, and that reminded me that whenever I read research studies about such things, it always seems that there are these immutable times. Well, you know, older people, you know, their circadian cycle changes, and some people are early sleepers and some people are late sleepers and so forth and so on. But if, you know, if you move around time zones, or the fact that people in, you know, in different parts of the world still, you know, adjust to their local time, that it feels like there's kind of a missing link there. I wonder if she could clarify how that works.
Well, the main you know, clue that we get of when to go to sleep depends on the sun, on the light-dark cycle, which is the most powerful information that our brain gets of when it's time to go to sleep, based on the circadian factor that you mentioned. So we, in general, we humans are diurnal animals, and therefore we prefer to go to sleep during the night. And so this is true across the entire globe, of course. But sleep is always the ability to falling asleep and stay asleep is always a compromise, is always due to two factors. One is the time of day. Again, at night for us is much easier to be asleep than during the day. It would be the opposite for a mouse. The other is what we call the homeostatic factor. So, of course, if you have been sleep deprived, or if you have been very intensely working for the entire day, you mount what we call the sleep pressure, and therefore the ability to go to sleep at any time is higher. So it's always the two components, and we know they're both important. We don't know exactly. I wouldn't be able to tell you, oh, this is 49% of the, you know, the strength of falling asleep, and the other is 51%. We don't really know. We know they're both important. We know that the relative importance of these two factors varies, again, across individuals. For some people who are, for instance, they get selected very often to do shift work because for them the circadian factor is less powerful, and therefore they can adapt then also to sleep because they are forced to during the day. For other people, that's just impossible, and they cannot keep up with that kind of work. So, you know, it's two components, and that's why experiments in flies and mice, again, because they have exactly the same kind of regulation, and we know a lot about the regulation of the time, of the clock in these animals. We can try to figure out how the two factors really work together, but it's obvious that they vary a lot in terms of their relative strength across individuals. And so, again, what works for one person may not work for the next one.
Catherine, thanks. Let's bring in Kay now in Milwaukee. Hi, Kay.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I had a question about, what you kind of mentioned it a little bit. What about somebody who works during the night half the week and then sleeps during the night the other half of the week? And how big does that affect? And what about sleep aids? How do they affect the quality? Are there particular types of sleep aids that are more harmful or that are more efficacious, such as trazodone versus Ambien? Those are my questions.
Yeah, so the shifts, there is quite a lot of research going on. Is very difficult, very expensive, the very time-consuming kind of research to try to figure out whether some patterns of shifts are easier to follow for most people and therefore more adaptive than others. It's very difficult. It depends also on the kind of work. And again, it depends a lot. It varies a lot across individuals. So some people who are able to adapt to that shift may not adapt to another one so easily. The issue about sleep aids, the short answer is there is no sleeping pill that can mimic sleep and that can give you, in the long run, all the benefits that sleep provides. And that's the problem. And the problem is because sleep, of course, is such a complex behavior in the brain. There are so many things and molecules that are changing. Any of the sleep aids or drugs that we use only affect one of these systems, not all of them. And therefore, it would be very naive to think that they can mimic what sleep really does. Having said that, of course, sometimes it's useful to take in the acute condition some of these aids to go to sleep, but it should never be the solution for the long term, because we know none of them actually is helpful in the long run.
There is something called local sleep, where people have been awake too long and then the brain takes a quick nap without giving notice. Can you explain what's happening there?
Yeah, this is a phenomenon that we described first, again in mice, but now we know that it's happening the same way in people, which is that only a very, very small part of the brain, a few neurons, we don't know exactly how many, but certainly a small group of neurons, shuts off literally and goes offline the way usually we do for all our neurons when we are asleep, in the real sleep, but does so during wake. And we think this is it's a phenomenon that happens when we are sleep deprived, or even now we know, not in conditions of sleep deprivation, but if we use that part of the brain very, very intensely for many, many hours because of training, learning, those neurons can literally tire more easily or earlier than other neurons and start needing to sleep more, probably. And that's why they go offline. Now, this is before the phenomenon that we call of microsleeps that very often is implicated in car accidents, for instance. In that case, we lose control of the car because it's the entire brain that goes to sleep, but only for a few seconds. But unfortunately, that's enough for an accident. The local sleep comes even earlier. So you would not be able to see, the person doesn't fall asleep and the head nods off as we see in microsleep. It's very subtle. It's only if you put electrodes or record the electroencephalogram in the brain of people with very high resolution that you can see this phenomenon. But unfortunately, it's happening. Not only that, but we know, unfortunately, that it has consequences. And we have seen this in people and in mice. If it happens in the wrong place at the wrong time, let's say in the part of the brain that is controlling your movement and you are trying to do a motor task, certainly there is an impairment.
We only have a few seconds left, but what happens next in your research? What more do we have to learn about sleep in the brain? Because you've been studying this for decades.
Yes, and it's embarrassing in one sense that we're still not content about the solution. Well, one thing, I think the evidence for this need for renormalization is quite strong. We want to study a lot of the development, because if this is true, the sleep is the price for plasticity and learning, that would be the explanation also why early on in development we need even more sleep. And so we want to test whether this process, this change in synaptic strength, happens especially in a young brain.
Dr. Chiarelli, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Dr. Chiara Chiarelli is a professor in UW-Madison Psychiatry Department and a principal investigator at the Wisconsin Institute for Sleep and Consciousness. Coming up, it's On Point. Meat-free burgers are sweeping the nation. Looks like meat, tastes like meat, but it's more complicated than that. Are they healthier or better for the planet? On Point explores that question after a news update. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.